Fa la 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 la. Deck the halls with boughs of holly. Fa la 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 la. Tis the season to be jolly. Fa la 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 la. Wash your hands, use hand sanitizer. Fa la 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 la.
You know the tune. If you're celebrating with your loved ones this holiday season, make sure to keep following the sanitary measures. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Hello, and welcome to CJPME's Debrief Podcast, where we discuss breaking events and issues in Canada related to human rights in Palestine and the broader Middle East. Together, we make sense of events in the region and how people in Canada can respond. On October 19th, Israel's Defense Minister designated six leading Palestinian human rights groups as terrorist organizations. Israel's use of counterterrorism laws to suppress the work of civil society in Palestine is nothing new. But outlawing large and credible Palestinian human rights organizations is a new escalation. What may be Israel's strategy in outlawing these human rights organizations, and what may be the best way for other countries, including Canada, to respond? This podcast is a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, CJPME, and seeks to advance its mission to empower Canadians of all backgrounds to promote justice, development, and peace in the Middle East. My name is Tom Woodley. I'm the president of CJPME and the podcast host for today. And with me is Michael Buchert, CJPME's VP and our podcast co-host. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Tom.
So, Michael, it's been a little bit more than a month since Israel outlawed these six organizations, and there's been a lot of international commentary, most of it negative, on the issue. But perhaps we should start with a review of these organizations, a few of the basics of the file, starting with a review of the organizations. What are they and what do they do?
Sure. As you mentioned, these are long-standing organizations that are very credible, have a huge international profile and relationship with officials and human rights groups around the world. So it really is a very serious escalation. So we'll go through each of these just briefly. The one that I mean, personally, I'm most familiar with, and others might be too, is Defense for Children International Palestine, or DCIP, which promotes and protects the rights of children under occupation.
Yeah.
You're familiar with them, right?
Right. Well, we both worked with them. We were working with for the International Interparliamentary Task Force to Promote Palestinian Human Rights. They're a member of that. They're our U.S. partner on that. But CJPME has been working with them for several years, most notably on the No Way to Treat a Child campaign, which was very active 2 or 3 years ago. And Canada was one of the partners of that campaign in Canada. But that campaign was actually quite successful in the U.S. and Canada in terms of talking to members of parliament about Israel's human rights abuses, specifically as it pertained to abuses against children. But yeah, they're quite well known and quite active and a very impressive organization. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And I know that like what you see on a daily basis is that they're out there whenever a child in Palestine is shot or abused or in some way. This is an organization that's on the ground and is researching, investigating the situation, monitoring this, and looking at overall trends. And so really they are one of the chief advocates for children's rights under occupation.
Absolutely, absolutely. And a key because, there is a certain interest in children and a certain sympathy for children. And it's a very good strategy in terms of helping people to get up to speed on the issues. What is actually Israel doing? But yeah, let's move on then.
Another one would be Al-Haq, which is a very prominent human rights group, international law organization, which participates pretty actively at the United Nations and has been involved in efforts to put together evidence for an upcoming, investigation by the International Criminal Court into Israeli human rights violations, into war crimes.
Yeah, and I looked them up. They've been around for 40 years. It's amazing. These are very credible organizations. Yeah,
absolutely. And I mean, they have so many connections with officials around the world. They're doing very important work. Yeah. A similar one actually is Adamir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association, which focuses on detainees, and it provides legal aid to Palestinian political prisoners and collects overall data on abuses in Israeli prisons.
Yeah. Some of our listeners may be familiar with Khalida Jarar, a lawyer who's often been imprisoned by Israel. She's been involved with Adamir for a long time. She was actually the director of Adamir for 12 years, 1993 to 2005. So it's quite, again, another very credible organization.
Absolutely. Another one is maybe not, doesn't have quite the same profile, but it's the BSAN Center for Research and Development, which provides programming for community development, youth, and ending violence against women. Again, this group has existed for more than 30 years, right, although it might not have exactly the same profile. Another group is the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, which provides food security and sort of advocates for the rights of Palestinian farmers under occupation, especially in Area C, which is under complete Israeli control. Right. It's existed for over 35 years. Are you familiar with this group?
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing that as I was doing a bit of poking around about them, one of the things that I discovered that they were, 10 years ago, they were accused of, again, being a front organization for terrorism work, and it was entirely disproved. There was an Israeli law organization, Shirat Hadin, which alleged that this union was a front for a terrorist organization. And they went to World Vision Australia and Australia Aid and sort of said, look, you're funding these organizations. You are personally, criminally, and civilly liable under Australian and U.S. law. World Vision Australia and Australia Aid, they investigated and they found absolutely no basis for the allegations and restarted the aid. So these types of allegations have been floating around, and
right,
various Israeli voices repeatedly have tried to shut these organizations down. Yeah.
Right. In that case, I guess, rather than Israel defining this group as a terrorist group, they simply took these accusations to donors and tried to get them to cut funding.
Right.
That didn't work. So maybe that's a reason why this designation came. No one is buying this.
Right.
Another one is the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees. Again, a long-term organization. It provides programs to empower women and fight against gender discrimination.
It's probably the least well-known of the six. I didn't find too much actually about them, but clearly they're doing something that Israel doesn't like. So, all right. So Israel alleges that these six groups are a front network for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. That often goes by PFLP, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. That's a small secular left-wing movement with both a political party and an armed faction that has carried out attacks against Israelis in the past. Now, Israel, in its accusation and its announcement on October 19th, they said these groups were, quote unquote, active under the cover of civil society organizations. In other words, the PFLP was active under the cover of civil society organizations. But I'm sorry, let me get this right. Israel saying these groups, these human rights groups, were active under the cover of civil society organizations, but in practice belong and constitute an arm of the PFLP leadership, the main activity of which is the liberation of Palestine and the destruction of Israel. So that was Israel's accusation there on October 19th. Now, in subsequent to that, there was a report by Israel's Shin Bet, a security service, which supposedly detailed Israel's evidence a few weeks ago. And you looked over that. What do you think? Does Israel have a case against these organizations?
Well, in short, no. And I mean, we should maybe also reference that, you know, Israel considers the PFLP a terrorist organization. It considers every political party in Palestine a terrorist organization, including Fatah. Anyway, this is a very complicated situation, but it turns out that the actual evidence that, you know, even that these six organizations have any connection to the PFLP, it's not substantiated. You know, Israel says that there's all this evidence that cannot be released. It won't tell anyone what any of this is. There was a leaked dossier that came out a couple of weeks ago that apparently Israeli officials were shopping around to European officials, trying to, again, to get them to cancel funding to these organizations, saying, here's definite proof that these NGOs are part of, are acting as a front for terrorist activity. The press got a hold of this, including the Associated Press, found it completely lacking any credibility whatsoever. There's no actual evidence in this. What there is essentially speculative hearsay from detainees in Israeli prisons who were, as part of this plea agreement, were willing to say some things like they heard that, or people know that, whatever, that you know, these organizations, they're participating or supporting in initiatives and activities that are by the PFLP, including things like community programs, like dance classes, which is absurd on the face of it. These are people who, they were in prison, they were working for a completely separate organization altogether. They had no personal information about what these organizations were doing. And even so, the only allegations that was gathered from this source had to do, again, with suspicions that these organizations had supported community events and initiatives. There were no actual allegations that these organizations were supporting terrorist activity. Not even non-credible accusations. They simply weren't making that claim. Right. So it's such a ridiculous, such a very weak case to be making such a huge crackdown against leading prominent human rights groups that it's just incredible.
Yeah. Now, when I was sort of looking that over, I got the impression that most of the evidence was based on the testimony of two individuals.
That's right.
Right, yeah. So just the two individuals. So it's
from
not like,
another organization.
Right. So it's not like there were dozens and dozens and allegations about certain individuals that may, well, some of the stuff you mentioned, the allegation about certain individuals who they said might have been involved with the PFLP at the same time that they might have been employees of these organizations. So very weak stuff.
Plus, with the thing with plea deals is that Israel really relies on these things to the point where they have more than a 99% conviction rate,
right,
because they essentially force Palestinian prisoners to confess to things they might not have even done in order to hopefully get a shortened sentence and to get out of prison quicker. And often this involves systemic torture within prisons. Some of these organizations like Adamir and DCIP actually document the torture and abuse that prisoners face. Even to that extent, it really throws a lot of sort of raises red flags about how credible this evidence to begin with.
Well, and what you're saying really mirrors exactly what one of the lawyers for Al-Haq said, Michael Sfard. He's a prominent Israeli lawyer who's representing Al-Haq. He said it's all guilt by association. It, quote, even if it's true that people who work in certain organizations are PFLP operatives, it does not follow that the organization itself is part of the PFLP. So he basically says if this is the best that Israel has, then this just demonstrates how weak
the entire case is. You know, normally you sort of, if you have a knockout punch, you lead with that, right? So if this is their knockout punch, they don't have anything. But just let's step back for a second and make an analogy. This what Israel's saying would be similar to someone in Canada saying, okay, there's a VP or director at Bell Canada who happens to be a member of the Liberal Party. Therefore, Bell Canada is controlled by senior members of the Liberal Party and constitutes an arm of the Liberal Party. And what's more, Bell Canada serves as a source of funding for the Liberal Party. I mean, it's just ridiculous. No one would sort of say, well, that's, you know, that proves it all, you know, Bell Canada's, you know.
Right. Yeah. And again, there's no accusations whatsoever that these groups are engaging in any kind of terrorist activity or supporting terrorist activity whatsoever.
Right, yeah. And this sort of model of some control is just crazy. So Israel's case against the six organizations obviously really comes across like a sham. But for the six organizations, there could be really deep impact on their operations. It's a real threat to what they're trying to do. So what are some of the ways we might see these organizations be impacted in the coming weeks and months?
Well, we don't know exactly how Israel is going to enforce this new designation, but the implications potentially are quite catastrophic. Under Israel's counterterrorism law that came in 2016, this terrorism designation gives Israel the authority to shut down these groups, prosecute their employees, seize their assets. For employees at these NGOs, staff could face criminal charges based on simply being a member in one of these groups or for taking part in the organization's activities, for example, by doing their job.
Just as you may point out, I was actually on a call a few days ago with one of the members of the Bizan Center, and he said, you know, people on this call could be accused by Israel of criminal activities just by being on this call with me. It's
right.
Crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. If this NGO wants to hire someone, that could be seen as recruiting for a terrorist organization. These people could go to jail for years.
Oh, wow.
Directors of these NGOs, if charged, could face up to 25 years in prison. One of the worst things is that, most insidious, is that it's a criminal offense to simply express support for one of these organizations and its activities that could put you in prison for 3 to 5 years. And these rules apply to Israelis and Palestinians on both sides of the green line. So, someone working in the West Bank for these NGOs could go to prison. An Israeli citizen expressing on Facebook, for example, that they support the human rights work of these groups, they could go to prison. Yeah. It's crazy. It's just a huge attack on civil society itself. It's also likely to hurt the ability of NGOs to fundraise. I mentioned earlier, they've been taking these claims around before, trying to get donors to stop funding these groups. Now, with the designation, there might actually be legal consequences. A lot of money that goes to the West Bank, I mean, it has to go through Israel. Those institutions may not continue to allow that funding to pass through.
Yeah.
They might lose all their funding completely.
Yeah. You know, again, on the call with the individual from the Bizan Center, he said actually that they had already had to close their liaison offices in Israel proper and that it already had started impacting their funding. So it's exactly what you're saying.
Right. Yeah. They could go to prison for continuing operations. And, you know, just like given the seriousness of the terrorism charge, if a military kills someone who's deemed a terrorist, no one really asks questions. People only really care when it's, officially civilians, women and children. To have these people, these human rights workers, defined from the start as terrorists, that really questions, like, how is their safety in danger? Are these people going to come across, if they disappear, is anyone going to care?
Right.
Like,
right.
It's that serious.
Well, that's sort of what Israel wants by casting this shadow over the work of these organizations, over these individuals. That's a clear danger. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So let's state the obvious on this. Israel has taken this step likely because they don't like the fact that these organizations are shedding light on Israel's human rights abuses. This is not the first time it's happened, has it? Israel sought to defund. You mentioned earlier that, you know, Israel was shopping around in Europe, sort of trying to present some very weak evidence, trying to get European funders to withdraw funding from these organizations. But Israel has a long history of trying to defund, obstruct, and intimidate organizations and individuals that expose its human rights abuses. One thing I found, I mean, there's just a lot of material out there about Israel's attempts to do this, but one Amnesty International report from 2016 listed quite a number of different things that they were aware of at that time. They mentioned Israeli ministers threatening physical harm and perhaps more to BDS founder Omar Barghouti. It mentions Israel authorities' arbitrary arrest of Palestinian human rights defenders Issa Amrul and Farid El-Atrash. It mentions the arrest and detention of Khalid Jarrah, who we mentioned earlier. It mentions Israel's decision to ban the Israeli human rights organization Breaking the Silence from speaking to Israeli soldiers. Breaking the Silence is former soldiers who then turn against or oppose the occupation. And so Israel's outlawed them from talking to Israeli soldiers. In 2016, Israel passed its infamous NGO law, which requires all Israeli human rights organizations to detail their foreign funding anytime they're with officials on TV, in newspapers, on billboards, any type of exposure. They have to say, well, we receive foreign funding. There was also Israel's expulsion of the Human Rights Watch director for Israel and Palestine, Omar Shaker. In 2019, and that's just a handful of cases. It just goes on and on. That this is entirely characteristic. Entirely, this is just a pattern that Israel has maintained for quite some time.
Right, and you know, even prior to the October terrorism designation, these same groups that are now being targeted were already facing related forms of repression. Just a few months ago, DCAIP, they had their offices in Ramallah raided by Israeli forces, had their files confiscated. They were sharing surveillance footage of the IDF raiding their offices.
Yeah.
Likewise, Israeli forces raided the headquarters of the Bisan Center, vandalizing their office, going through their files, confiscating their equipment. And actually, employees from three of these targeted NGOs, just days before these terrorist designation was announced, discovered that on their phones was Israeli spyware by the NSO group, which is facing a lot of, I guess, negative media attention these days because their spyware has been found on the phones of journalists and human rights defenders around the world on behalf of regimes like the UAE, Saudi Arabia, other countries that are buying this spyware. And some of these very NGO employees found this spyware on their phones.
Yeah.
And this is spyware that can really track everything that they're doing. It requires no action on part of the people who own their phones for it to kick in.
Yeah.
So it's really insidious. And the spying has been going on for over a year. So, I mean, these human rights defenders have been surveilled. They've been repressed for a long time, and this is just escalating things further.
Yeah, there. And on that story about the Pegasus software, we may do another podcast on that, depending on how things play out on that. But there's obviously a big story behind that. So Israel takes this outrageous actions for whatever reason, and lots of people are crying foul. So let's start with some of the human rights organizations and international bodies. What are some of the ones that you've sort of picked out that have sort of spoken out against this?
Well, some of the notable responses right from the start is Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch had a joint statement. They said, this decision is an alarming escalation that threatens to shut down the work of Palestine's most prominent civil society organizations. The decades-long failure of the international community to challenge grave Israeli human rights abuses and impose meaningful consequences for them has emboldened Israeli authorities to act in this brazen manner.
Yeah.
A couple days later, more than 20 Israeli human rights groups, some of the most prominent groups in Israel, published a full-page newspaper ad saying that this move was a draconian measure that criminalizes critical human rights work and that criminalizing such work is an act of cowardice characteristic of repressive authoritarian regimes.
Yeah.
And then we also saw the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights say that Israel's decision to designate six Palestinian civil society organizations as terrorist organizations is an attack on human rights defenders, on freedoms of association, opinion, and expression, and on the right to public participation, and should be immediately revoked.
Yeah. So basically, sort of uniform criticism, uniform condemnation.
Absolutely.
There's no redeeming aspect that, you know, somehow, well, you know, we'll check or we'll, you know, this is a, no, it's just across the board, everyone is highly critical of this. Now, there are two other points that I think we should make, aside from the fact that what the hell is Israel doing with all this, criminalizing human rights organizations. There is a UN mandate to allow human rights groups to do their work. The UN has a declaration on human rights defenders. It doesn't get too much play. It doesn't get talked about much. But this declaration on human rights defenders actually specifically articulates the right of civil society groups to conduct human rights work safely and without criminalization, and the right to form associations and to seek, obtain, receive, and hold information related to human rights. So, you know, Israel is specifically violating this very clear mandate that the UN has put out for a number of years, saying you've just got to let human rights groups do their work. Right. Not only that, Israel's also, like, this is, you know, a lot of Israeli advocates like to sort of trumpet the fact that Israel's a democracy, Israel's a democracy. But what actually is democracy? And sometimes we take a simplistic view that elections equal democracy. If you have elections once in a while, you're a democracy. But actually, democracy is much more than that. There's a Stanford professor, Larry Diamond, has a simple model for what constitutes a democracy. And he says there are 4 points. Obviously, a political system for choosing and replacing the government, obviously through free and fair elections. So point number one is elections. Point number two, though, is the active participation of people as citizens in politics and civic life. Point number three, protection of the human rights of all citizens. And point number four, a rule of law in which the laws and procedures apply equally to all citizens. Now, by doing this, by criminalizing these organizations, Israel is actually violating three of those four things. It's preventing Palestinians from participating in the civic life of their community. It's undermining the protection of human rights of all citizens. And it's also sort of undermining the rule of law. If the government could just go willy-nilly, you know, accusing whoever of whatever, well, where's the rule of law? So this is really, in addition to the international condemnation, this has serious, Israeli citizens should be concerned as well, because this has really deep implications for Israeli society as a whole.
Right. And I guess just to add to that, the occupied West Bank is essentially an Israeli military dictatorship already.
Yeah.
Their democracy is already, essentially non-existent. But this affects people in Israel just as much as it does in the West Bank. And so absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, there are also some other countries. So you mentioned a few of the human rights organizations and international organizations. There are a few, quite a number of countries have spoken out against Israel's act. The United States, which is probably Israel's closest ally, they've been on the tough side with Israel on this. They said Israel didn't give them advance warning. They said they wanted to seek clarification from Israel. Of course, in Israel, this was depicted as a harsh public rebuke.
Right. It's pretty weak on its face, but it was certainly seen in Israel as the U.S. sort of, taking Israel to task a little bit.
Exactly. The European Union pushed back and said it was proud of its continued support to civil society that contributes to peace efforts and confidence building between Israelis and Palestinians, and said it would, work with Israeli authorities to look for more, to understand more information. But they asserted that past allegations have been unsubstantiated. So very skeptical from the European Union.
Yeah, and there have been sort of similar statements from a bunch of countries that take a similar line of expressing, huge support for Palestinian civil society and for their existing partnerships, saying they're going to look into this further, but also saying that the evidence so far is not credible.
Exactly.
And so if the evidence that has been leaked is really all that Israel has, then there's not going to be any clarification that changes world opinion on this. And
no.
So I think hopefully the international community can become more stronger in their opposition to this.
Right. So I think basically the bottom line is these other countries are saying, look, we're not going to outright dismiss your claims, but we're very skeptical.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. So has Canada said anything so far?
No, there has not been a single statement from any Canadian official whatsoever with a position or statement on this. There was one tweet by the Canada's ambassador to Israel. She was describing a meeting with a UN official and describing a couple of topics that were brought up, including concerns over the designation. But that's not a statement. That's That's not a position of what Canada thinks about this. An offhand description of what someone else is saying.
By a civil servant.
By a civil servant. Right. Is, I mean, other than that, no Canadian official has said anything. And I think that's really embarrassing.
Yeah.
And it's really disappointing. However, luckily, we have seen some in the opposition. So Heather McPherson is the NDP's new foreign affairs critic. Mm-hmm. She tweeted a very positive tweet, which I'll quote.
Yeah, go ahead.
I am deeply concerned with recent news that Israel has labeled six Palestinian human rights groups as terrorist organizations. Canada must do everything possible to ensure human rights organizations are allowed to carry out their essential work. That's a pretty good statement. Hopefully we can build on that.
Well, that's right. And it's not like she's sticking her neck out. She's basically stating the opposite. Yeah, we should be. Anyone, wherever something like this might happen, you'd think that any Canadian government would sort of say, we're concerned about human rights organizations that are being criminalized. You know,
exactly.
Whether Israel or anywhere else. But yeah, not a word from the Liberal government.
Yeah. So there were three NDP MPs who went a little bit further in their condemnation, including Nikki Ashton, Leah Gazan, Matthew Green, who signed a joint statement from the Interparliamentary Task Force, which is based of, I guess, officials in the U.S. and Europe, which condemned Israel's attack on civil society, urged governments to use all available means to end Israel's impunity, and hold authorities accountable for their egregious attacks on civil society and human rights defenders. Which is a great statement, and it was also signed by Quebec member of the National Assembly, Ruba Ghazal.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually just yesterday, Liberal MP Nathaniel Erskine-Smith has sponsored a petition in Parliament asking Canada to demand that Israel reverse the terrorist designation.
Right.
So sponsoring a petition isn't exactly like making your own statements, but it is sort of associating your name with a demand. And so it's not nothing, but this is the only things we've seen from our political class.
Right. But let's be clear as well. Nathaniel Erskine-Smith in no way sort of represents the Liberal Party, no way speaks for it. And on many issues, he's sort of on the periphery of the Liberal Party.
Right.
As much as we appreciate and admire his willingness to sort of take up these petitions that are suggested to him by Palestinian solidarity groups, this is by no means a reflection of where Trudeau or Melanie Joly, our foreign affairs minister, stands on this.
Right.
Yeah.
And we have to think that the Israeli government, as it's trying to justify this move, is reaching out to the U.S., to Europe. Is it not also reaching out to Canada? Have Canadian officials had no meetings with Israel about this? Have they seen the evidence, supposed evidence? Do they have any opinion on this whatsoever? We don't know.
Yeah.
And it's Canada claims to stand up for human rights, international law. It's completely silent on this huge attack on those very principles.
Right. And you have to question if this happened in another country, you know.
Right.
If this happened in Venezuela, would they be
silent? We'd be hearing about it.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So it's very selective, very unfortunate how they're sort of the bad guys and the good guys in the way Canada carries out its foreign policy.
Yeah.
And they're just very unwilling to hold Israel to account on things like this. So moving forward, I guess the things we need to watch for are, on the one hand, how will Israel implement its designation? Will Canada's foreign affairs minister or Ministry of Global Affairs speak out in any way on this? And then I guess the third question or third thing we need to think about is, how should civil society handle this?
Yeah, and I mean, the most important thing, I think, is to maintain relationships we have with these organizations and continue to support their work, and to not allow Israel's designation to do what it's intended to do, which is to sever those relationships and isolate Palestinian human rights defenders from the rest of the world.
Right.
But there are things that Canada can do that I think we need to continue calling for. Condemn the criminalization and reject the designation, call for a reversal of that, but also refuse in any way to comply with it. If it ever comes up, if Israel is ever demanding certain sort of funding, for example, to be stopped, that Canada absolutely rejects that, or is forcing banks to stop sending money, for example, that those must be absolutely rejected.
Let's hope.
You
know,
let's hope.
But, you know, it's really not very encouraging that there hasn't been sort of a word of skepticism or word of concern on the part of Canada. So it's very concerning.
Right. Another thing that, again, there's no signs that Canada's prepared to do this yet, but Canada must do, is to hold Israeli officials accountable for these attacks, to say that we can't continue to allow this this behavior to happen with impunity. There have to be consequences.
Yeah. Now, you had mentioned the possibility of arms embargoes, but there is a progressive sort of, there's a number of different things Canada could do, you know, short of, you know, sending troops or something like that. Of course, they're never going to do that, but they can do things like, suspend the Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement. They could implement an arms embargo. There are a number of sort of smaller sort of diplomatic type steps that they can do to sort of pressure Israel on this, isn't there?
That's right. We could cancel meetings of cooperation that military officials have with Israeli military officials. There's so many different ways that we could put some pressure on Israel to reverse this.
Right.
And you know what? Ultimately, I think Canada has to do everything it can to support the work of these human rights defenders, including by opening their embassies, their offices in Tel Aviv and in Ramallah, to these groups. If these groups need anything from them, they should be able to ask, and Canada should give it to them.
Yeah. I mean, that would be quite remarkable. I mean, if indeed Israel is trying to close these organizations, you know, could the Canadian embassy provide some office space to them? I mean, that would be... I'm skeptical that the Liberal government would do that, but that would certainly be the type of thing that a candidate that we could admire would do.
That's right. And, you know, during apartheid in South Africa, the Israeli embassy, the Canadian embassy used to provide support to human rights defenders in South Africa, and we could be doing the same thing now.
Yeah, absolutely. So, along those lines, we should note and could note that CJPME has an email campaign that listeners can participate. We already have over 2,000 emails so far. This campaign allows you to email the entire cabinet, which
That's
is
right.
close to 40 people, but they're the ones that sort of call the shots at the top of the government. So if you participate in this campaign, you'll find the link in the podcast description page. You can email every single cabinet member, as long as your own local MP, and urge them to protect these Palestinian human rights defenders. You'll find it on the CJPME website, and as I say, on the description page for the podcast. And I think one final point that we should mention before we close out here is this is going to impact not just these Palestinian human rights organizations, is it? It's going to impact everyone around the world, even groups like CJPME. If Israel manages to silence these groups, it's going to make it much, much harder for CJPME to do the type of work that we do in terms of, you know, fighting for Palestinian human rights abroad and providing getting the details and data for our assertions. So these things, they shed light on Israel's abuses, and Israel's trying to banish this light. So here at CJPME, we depend on this, don't we? I mean, how frequently you're plugged into all sorts of different things, aren't you, Michael?
But these are some of the main groups that we rely on for information, and as do many people around the world. And so absolutely, this is going to affect our ability to know what's going on the ground and to be able to amplify Palestinian voices.
Right. So this is serious. This is going to impact everybody in the International Palestine Solidarity Movement. So this is very, very severe. So I guess we'll leave it at that, huh?
That's a lot of information for people to digest, I think. And I think we'll continue to come back to this issue as, it's not going away anytime soon.
We're just getting evolved.
Hopefully we can have an episode one day of Canada's amazing response to this, condemning Israel, expressing support for Palestinian human rights defenders. And if we continue to do our work, maybe we can push a better response. But we're just going to have to keep following it.
That's it. So we will just have to keep pushing at it. So we'll leave it at that. We'll watch the situation closely as it unfolds. If Israel carries out its threats to crack down on these human rights organizations as if they were terrorist organizations, we'll let you know. We'll keep you up to date. Hopefully this podcast here today has provided some context for the story, plus some things to watch for moving forward. If you've liked our podcast today, please subscribe to our channel. We're on all the major podcast platforms in addition to YouTube. Thanks to all our supporters who helped make this podcast and all CJPME's other activities possible. Thanks also to Madeleine Moffitt, our podcast engineer and consultant. And we'll leave it at that. That's it for now. Look forward to having everyone with us next time. Take care. We'll see you all again soon.
غنيلو Welcome to the Mondo Weiss Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Reed. At Mondo Weiss, we cover the movements, activists, and policymakers who affect the struggle for freedom in Palestine. In today's episode, Yumna Patel speaks with Palestinian farmers working to bring in their olive crop as the harvest season winds down. This is a shorter episode that captures their stories and some of the sounds of the olive harvest.
These are the familiar sounds of the Palestinian olive harvest. Tree branches shaking, hands plucking the ripe olives off their branches, and the pitter-patter as olives fall to the ground. The olive harvest is a landmark occasion in Palestine and is celebrated and cherished by families in the occupied West Bank every year. Once the first rain of the autumn season falls, Palestinian families go to their olive groves, where they spend the next few weeks combing through their fields, and pick every last olive off the trees before the winter frost sets in. On the outskirts of Bethlehem, on a small plot of land surrounded by a makeshift fence, what seems like a typical olive harvest scene unfolds. An elderly woman by the name of Yasser sits on a rickety chair in the middle of an olive grove, while dozens of people, men, women, teenagers, and children, pick the olives off the trees around her. The people surrounding her, however, are not Yasser's children or family members. In fact, up until today, she hadn't met most of them. That's Asil Jafari, a young woman from the city of Bethlehem. She's one of dozens of volunteers who came from across the West Bank to help Yasser pick her olives before the harvest ends. The main reason we're here today is to support the farmers. As youth, we have a social responsibility to volunteer and be here in places like this. Umm Yasar, now in her late 70s, is a widow and lives alone. With no close family members nearby, Umm Yasar, who has a multitude of health issues, relies on volunteers and local activists to help harvest her olives, which she planted herself decades ago. For years, I would come and go to this land and plant trees. I planted everything myself. There isn't a single kind of tree here that I didn't plant. There are olive trees, apples, apricots, plums, pomegranates, za'atar, sage, lemons, oranges, everything. I used to be strong and healthy and took care of this land well. But after my son died, I started to have heart problems, issues with my kidneys, joints, and blood pressure. I couldn't take care of the land anymore. While Umm Yasar is no longer physically capable of harvesting her olive trees, there's another, more sinister reason for why the volunteers have come to help her. I'm surrounded. There's a settlement here to my right, another settlement to my left, and a settlement behind me, and a settler road in front of me. I'm surrounded on all four sides. This settlement over here is half a kilometer away from me. Elazar, Daniel, Efrat, and there's another one on top. Surrounded by Israeli settlements and settler roads, over the years, Umm Yasar's land has been the target of several settler attacks. There isn't a proper fence around my land. Sometimes I would come to work and would find all my crops were gone. One time, the Israeli settlers cut down 22 of my trees, 22 olive trees. Last year, Umm Yasar came to her land to harvest her olives, only to find that the harvest had been stolen, and not a single olive was left on her trees. I went crazy. I lost my mind when I saw it. I started crying, hitting myself, screaming. I couldn't believe it. It wasn't an easy thing to bear. When you tire yourself and put all your energy into these trees all year, only to come and finally pick them and not find them. In the days leading up to this year's harvest, Umm Yasar said she couldn't sleep for fear that she would come back and find her olives missing again. Yesterday, it didn't leave my mind. I kept waking up in the middle of the night thinking, someone probably broke down the gate, someone cut down my trees, or someone stole the olives. I didn't sleep. I'm always having nightmares about it. No matter how hard I try, I can't stop worrying. Mundir Amira is a local activist with a popular resistance committee in the West Bank. He's been helping Umm Yasar farm her land for years and helped organize the trip to come harvest her olives this season. Amira is also part of the group Faza, a collective of volunteers and activists that travel to hotspots throughout the occupied territory during the olive harvest season in an effort to help Palestinian farmers and protect them from settler attacks. Our work and activities focus on the land that are close to the settlements and are subject to attacks from the settlers. This is one of the areas that is constantly under settler attack. It's really important for us that the farmer doesn't feel like they are alone. When I go to someone's land, it doesn't matter who the owner is. All that matters is that these people are under attack and are scared to go to their land. So that's where my role comes in. The real resistance is to stand on your land and support farmers and protect this land. And though Amira carries a smile on his face, he says there's always a fear in the back of his mind that things here could immediately go south. At any moment, the settlers or soldiers could come and attack us here. During this olive harvest season, our volunteers have come under attack many times. I've been arrested myself, along with my colleagues. Many of them have also been injured. This season used to be a happy and joyous season, and a blessed season that the Palestinian farmers would wait for all year round. But unfortunately, today, it's turned into a season of fear. The Palestinian farmer waits in fear and worry, because with every olive he harvests, he's waiting for an attack from the settlers. Despite the very imminent threat that activists like Amira face, he insists that they must continue to maintain a presence during the olive harvest season, not only to help the farmers, but to take a stand against the Israeli occupation.
Stealing olives, cutting down trees, preventing farmers from accessing their lands. This is all part of the attempt to displace and remove Palestinians from their land. And we are here to say that this land is ours. We will continue to harvest and plant it, and we will continue to defend it with everything we have. By the end of the afternoon, every last olive had been picked from Umm Yasser's trees, and to her relief, the day went off without any problems. For now, she'll pack up this year's harvest and turn it into olive oil that will last her until next year's harvest. Until then, she says that as long as her health permits, she'll keep coming to her land to take care of her olive trees, no matter what dangers she may face. Olives are our heritage. They are everything. The olive trees have everything we need. All of the land, it means the world to me, not just the olive trees. Your land is your life. Your land is your soul. There's nothing more important than your land. It's more important than life itself.
Thanks for listening to our show, a production of MondoWeiss.net. The music is from Sound of Picture. Visit our site to sign up for free daily and weekly newsletters on Palestine, Israel, and related U.S. politics.
So that's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
I'm Martin Carly, and I like to popularize science. Vaccination against COVID-19 for children aged 5 to 11 has begun. As parents, you may be asking if your child will receive the same vaccine as adults. The vaccine used for children younger than 12 years old contains a smaller amount of mRNA because children's immune systems respond better than those of adults. And even though they're given smaller doses, the vaccine is just as effective.
For more information, visit quebec.ca/youthvaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Thank you.